This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, we're going to be talking about what's wrong with capitalism and how to imagine and arrive at a better system. With me to talk about this is Eric Olenright, professor of sociology at the University of Wisconsin and author of this great, new, profound book, Envisioning Real Utopias. Eric Olenright, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be here.
Why is it so important to envision utopias? Or real utopias?
Yes, I think it's important to envision real utopias, not just plain ordinary utopias. The word utopia means nowhere. And when people talk about utopia in a more general way, often their ideas are dismissed. A good way of criticizing someone is to say, oh, you're being utopian. Utopia, therefore, suggests something which sounds good, but it's completely unrealistic. It's an impossibility, a fantasy. And we know that if people orient their politics around fantasies, it can lead to disasters, not constructive change. And yet, there's something about utopian imagination, which is, I think, vital to any progressive social movement. People have to be inspired by some kind of ideal that they're aspiring to. And that's why I put together the word real with utopia. It is, it's a contradiction in terms. It's an oxymoron. But that tension is exactly what I'm trying to capture. So the real part of real utopia refers to thinking about how institutions really work, what the real constraints on possibilities are because of what we know about how social phenomena operate. It means paying a special attention to unintended consequences and perverse effects, all of these kinds of things that sociologists discuss, and yet not abandoning the utopian vision, to combine institutional analysis with these moral, philosophical discussions of ideals.
But your utopia, or your real utopia, isn't a utopia of paradise, much less a utopia where you have a new man or a new human being or something fanciful like that.
That's right. I'm interested in visions of alternatives in which we can prefigure the alternatives in the world in which we live, that we create the alternatives in the spaces possible in the societies that we inhabit, and that the utopian vision, therefore, is a way of mobilizing activity for a direction of transformation in which the actual destination remains only weakly specified. I want to give precision to the direction, but not to the destination. So that when we make small changes, we know that they're moving in the right direction, as opposed to small changes that just go in circles.
I had Margaret Atwood, the Canadian fiction and writer and poet and essayist, on the show several months ago, and she recoils at utopias. She says, all utopias lead to the killing fields of the Khmer Rouge, and you were suggesting early on, I think, the dangers in some utopias. Why do you think you can talk about utopia without moving in that disastrous direction?
Oh, I think the disastrous direction comes from a false sense of certainty. When people believe they have a certain absolute belief in the character of the destination itself. And therefore, if you're absolutely clear about the destination, then the question of the costs in the moment of getting there becomes less disturbing. If you know that you can reach paradise, if only you bear the costs of the transition, then ruthless costs seem justified. Now, my real utopia perspective, first of all, rejects certainty. We have no absolute certainty about destinations, and emphasizes process of transformation as prefiguring the destination rather than waiting for the destination. So the guts of my real utopian vision centers around creating the possibilities of a radically democratic and egalitarian society, the process to get there also has to be radically democratic and egalitarian, building democratic egalitarian alternatives as we build towards an alternative to the society as a whole. And if you take that perspective, then it's much less likely that you would sacrifice the present generation for future paradise, because the very act of sacrifice is a denial of the possibility of those kinds of transformations.
I'm speaking with Eric Olenright, who has this profound, deeply layered new book called Envisioning Real Utopias. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. When you define it as a radical, egalitarian, democratic view, and you get to the nuts and bolts of it, it doesn't seem so pie in the sky to me. At least the vision isn't. The getting there is a trickier aspect, but why don't you explain what it means? Basically, you have a concept where people would have a guaranteed income, for one thing, and that that there would be democratic participation in control of the economy and full democratic control of the political system, which is to say that private business wouldn't be dominating the economy and the political system as it is in the U.S. right now.
Yeah, I think the way I like to approach clarifying what the ideal is to begin by trying to specify the moral foundations of it. What's the deep moral intuition about the kind of world we'd like to see? What are the principles? You clarify the principles, and then you ask what kinds of institutions move us in the direction of those principles, rather than what kind of institutions fully embody in an uncompromising way those principles. So I'm interested in specifying the principles of a destination and then the institutional changes that move in that direction. So the principles, then. There's two principles that I lay out in the book. One centers on the notion of equality, and one is more focused on the question of democracy. The equality one goes as follows. In a socially just society, understood in this egalitarian way, in a just society, all people have equal access to the necessary social and material means to live a flourishing life. That's a pretty complicated formulation. It doesn't say, in a just society, all people are equal. It doesn't just stop there. It specifies that notion of equality and justice with respect to a fairly complicated set of elements. I say equal access to. So access is kind of like equal opportunity, but I think of equal opportunity as a narrower way of understanding the problem. Equal access to the conditions to live a flourishing life is a stronger way of saying all people should have throughout their lives the opportunity, that is the access, to what it takes to flourish. I then specify those conditions as both social and material. Material means the basic economic and material conditions of life, the standards of living, the material resources. But I also include the social conditions to live a flourishing life, which centers around issues of dignity, respect, and inclusion, social inclusion.
Lack of discrimination.
Lack of discrimination. But it's a little stronger than just lack of discrimination, because the word discrimination is mainly about access to resources. This is really about respect as well as discrimination, recognition as a full and equal member of a community.
And then the other half is the political half.
Is the political one. And so on the political one, I say, in a politically just society, all people have equal access to the necessary means to participate fully in the decisions which affect their lives, both as individuals and as members of a collectivity. Now, again, that's a pretty complicated formulation. This has to do with access to the conditions to participate in decision-making. Over those things which affect your life as a separate person and those things which affect your life as a member of a community. The part that's about your separate life, your life as a separate person, that's what we conventionally call freedom. That's a good old American value. Freedom basically means you have the right to control decisions which affect you. A lot of the things, however, don't just affect you, they affect others. Things those decisions which affect you jointly with others, the right to have equal participation in those decisions is what we call democracy. So that's the second prong of this two-pronged ideal. Both of them center around equal access, an equality of access to the conditions of freedom and democracy for the second principle, equality of access to the conditions to live a flourishing life in the first principle.
Let's talk about the first part of that, Eric Olenright, and that is equal access economically. In this country, there's the myth of equality of opportunity. And you have a critique of that. It's part of your chapter that's called What's So Bad About Capitalism. Why don't we have equality of, how don't we have equality of opportunity here?
Now, when people talk about equality of opportunity, particularly those people who are defending existing institutions, they make a sharp distinction between what they refer to as equality of outcome and equality of opportunity. The claim in this standard view is that it doesn't matter how unequal the outcomes are. It doesn't matter that we have Bill Gates and we have poor people, so long as everybody has equal opportunity to get into those statuses. My position is that it's incoherent to say that you don't care about equality of outcome if you're serious about equality of opportunity. The inequalities of outcome, that is, of the actual conditions of life of people, massively block anything remotely like equality of opportunity. This is trivially the case if you think about children. Being born in the central city of the United States or being born in a rich suburb means having massively different possibilities of life. That's because so long as children are raised in families, equality of inequalities of outcome shape the opportunities that children will have. And there's no conceivable way of getting rid of that inequality of opportunity, even seriously mitigating it, without doing something about the inequality of condition.
I mean, even if you taxed 100% of Bill Gates' income, the fact that he could raise his kids with enormous benefits would give them a tremendous head start.
That's right. So it's a complete mystification of the problem to say, yes, I'm for equality of opportunity, but don't touch the distribution. You can't be for equality of opportunity without massively affecting the inequalities in the outcomes.
It's also just a straight-up lie that we have equality of opportunity here,
right,
leaving aside the outcomes.
Right. Well, but a major reason why we don't have inequality of opportunity is because of the inequality of outcomes. A lot of the other processes come in the wake of that fundamental inequality. And those inequalities of outcomes are inherent in an economy that is dominated by capitalism. Capitalism is a machine for generating massive inequalities in the conditions of life, which massively shape the opportunities that people have, or in my terms, the access they have to the conditions to live a flourishing life.
And it is one of the central moral indictments in your chapter, What's So Bad About Capitalism, that capitalism perpetuates unnecessary human suffering.
Right.
And I think you have 11 indictments. That's the first one, and it may be the most, certainly one of the most morally compelling ones. And to what extent does it, how does it perpetuate unnecessary human suffering?
Yes, and I want to emphasize there's a particular nuance in that formulation. My claim is that capitalism perpetuates unnecessary human suffering. That's not the same as saying that capitalism and its development hasn't also reduced human suffering. That is, one can make the argument, and I think it's a reasonable one, that in the course of capitalist development, lifespans have increased, malnourishment has decreased relative to earlier periods, disease has been reduced. So there's some sense or other in which there's less human suffering in, let's say, in a rich country like the United States today than there was 100 years ago. So my claim is not that capitalist development doesn't, in certain respects, reduce human suffering, but rather that it creates the possibility of the massive reduction of human suffering and it blocks the realization of that possibility. That's what I mean by unnecessary human suffering. A big part of that comes from its inequalities, because inequality doesn't just mean some have more and some have less. It means that some have not enough. The inequalities of capitalism lead to genuine deprivations, not simply some people consuming less than other people. So it's the mechanism for the perpetuation of human suffering is, in its simplest form, because of the inequalities, but it's also because of the irrationalities of capitalism, the maluse of our resources, the way in which our resources, which could be used for public goods, for the creation of new conditions for flourishing, are blocked because of the way resources are monopolized for private purposes.
But back to the first part of it, I mean, an essential ingredient is that the owners of capital want to employ people for the least amount of money possible, and the more people they have unemployed or getting these subsistence wages, the greater their profits.
Yeah, now, here's a characteristic move of my work on these questions. As a first approximation statement, that's fine. But in fact, I think it's not actually the case that capitalists necessarily always want to pay the least possible to people. Capitalists' employers face a problem with their employees. They need to motivate them to work, as well as extract effort from them in the form of profits. If you pay workers the least possible, that also increases turnover. It means that they're less committed to their work and so on. So there's a complicated dynamic in capitalism which constrains the behavior of capitalists to not always be the caricatured maximum exploiters that, sometimes are, as critics we like to say. I don't think we have to posit that capitalists are all out to pay workers the least possible to still criticize capitalism for blocking the possibilities of a socially just society within which the conditions for flourishing become more universally shared. What capitalism does is create a necessary condition for the unequal distribution of those possibilities of flourishing.
I'm speaking with Eric Olenright. He's the author of Envisioning Real Utopias. He's a professor of sociology and has been for many years at the University of Wisconsin. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine here in Madison, Wisconsin, where this show originates. Could you talk a little bit more, Eric, about your idea of this unconditional basic income, what sometimes called a social wage?
Right. So let me first restate the puzzle, so to speak, of the book, in which, therefore, basic income is one of the parts of the answer. So the basic puzzle is, if we have an indictment of capitalism, if we see it creates a range of harms and blocks certain kinds of human potentials, both for flourishing and for democracy, then the question is, well, what can you do about it? What kinds of changes in our institutions would move us in the direction of more equality with respect to that first principle and more democracy with respect to the second? What the book then tries to do is explore a very wide range of examples of things that have actually occurred in existing societies in different places around the world, as well as certain theoretical proposals which would advance the cause of both equality and democracy. Now, in those terms, I think an unconditional basic income is a particularly interesting proposal. As a proposal, it's very simple. An unconditional basic income simply means every legal resident of a particular social unit, let's say a country for simplicity, is given unconditionally a monthly stipend sufficient to live above the poverty line. Let's call that the no-frills but adequate standard of living. So it doesn't mean that everybody gets as much as they want. It just means everybody has enough to live at what would be considered a morally acceptable no-frills level of living. This would be, of course, a massive change in the way distribution occurs in our economy. By the way, I like to call this an alternative system of distribution rather than redistribution. Redistribution, that term, redistribution, suggests that there's something natural that occurs that we call distribution, and then we intervene to change it. Rather, I think we have distribution caused by the combination of what states do, what private actors do, and what individual persons do, what firms do and what persons do. This is a new way of organizing distribution. It says that part of distribution is allocated to people simply on the basis of human right. Everybody gets a standard of living sufficient to live an acceptable way of life. And the rest of distribution is organized through markets and exchange and other mechanisms. This would be a very massive change in the way distribution works. In the most developed welfare states, such as Northern Europe, it wouldn't actually be that costly. They already have something very close to an unconditional basic income, except it's produced through a patchwork of very specialized programs. If you have enough special programs, unemployment insurance, single mother payments, child allowances, general welfare, if you have enough special purpose things, in fact, almost everybody who needs it gets a basic income. But an unconditional basic income is different. First of all, it's very simple. It's administratively easy. The overhead costs of running a basic income system are much less than running an unemployment insurance system. Doesn't require a lot of monitoring. It also has the character of making working in a labor market for a capitalist employer much more like a voluntary choice. One quip for this is that it makes capitalism between consenting adults. And capitalism between consenting adults is less objectionable than capitalism between a person who is forced to sell their labor power and a employer who is seeking labor power.
So it would take the coercion out of the labor market.
Right, much of the coercion. You know, I don't think we should overstate it. There are reasons why people will want to earn more money than the basic income, which have a compelling quality to them. So it's not exactly like completely eliminating coercion, but it's moving certainly in that direction.
You also say it would have an interesting impact on the way labor is valued.
Yes. Well, it has lots of ramifications. I think one of the most interesting, and the one that I think I emphasize in the book, is the following. An alternative way of organizing production to conventional capitalism would be worker co-ops, worker-owned firms, where workers come together to produce goods and services, still for a market, but they do so not as employees, but as co-producers with fellow workers. One of the problems with worker co-ops, however, is that at the same time they're producing for a market, they have to also produce sufficient income on which to live. So to speak, the problem for worker co-ops is that workers have to eat. What an unconditional basic income does is guarantee the basic subsistence of workers who then are free to set up a worker co-op without having to worry about instantly generating sufficient income to support themselves and their families. It also means, in a conventional capitalist banking sense, the creditworthiness of worker co-ops suddenly improves. Why are banks hesitant to lend money to worker co-ops? It's because worker co-ops have a very high risk of bankruptcy. One of the reasons they have a high risk of bankruptcy is that it's very difficult for worker co-ops to survive long enough to become viable businesses. And that's because they have to eat while they're doing it. So an unconditional basic income is kind of like a subsidy to the credit market to loan money for the capital that worker co-ops would need. So one idea, and this is an idea elaborated in the book, is that an unconditional basic income can be thought of as a way of reorganizing the system of distribution such as to remove the disadvantage that worker co-ops have in their competition with capitalist firms.
Speaking with Eric Olenright, he's the author of Envisioning Real Utopias, and we've been envisioning some here in the last 20 minutes or so. How do we get there?
Well, I have less insight, I'm afraid, on the purely strategic question of how we get there in the sense of how do you mobilize political parties capable of having this as part of their program. In my discussion of Envisioning Real Utopias, I distinguish three problems about alternatives: the desirability of alternatives, the viability, would they work, of alternatives, and the achievability of alternatives. That is, how do you actually go about creating them? Most of the book is preoccupied with the viability problem, some with the desirability problem. When I get to the achievability problem, I propose a way of thinking about the problem rather than a specific set of prescriptions for how in the United States we should go about it.
And it does seem especially daunting here in the United States.
So the way I approach the achievability problem is to distinguish three kinds of strategic logics that social movements, political parties, and activists over the history of anti-capitalist progressive movements, three kinds of strategic logics which people have adopted. I call these ruptural logics, interstitial logics, and symbiotic logics, three logics of transformation. Ruptural logics correspond to revolutionary strategies to have a decisive break with the nature of the system. Interstitial logics imagine producing transformation by building the alternatives in the spaces and cracks of the existing society where possible. Worker co-ops are an example of an interstitial strategy. And symbiotic strategies imagine using the existing state, the capitalist state, to create more vibrant spaces for interstitial strategies, but in ways that actually makes capitalism work better. So symbiotic strategies have this inherently contradictory quality of solving problems in the here and now, but in such a way as to open up more spaces for transformation, both now and in the future.
But the problem is they also strengthen the system in the process.
Right. They also strengthen the system in the process. Now, this poses an interesting problem, I think. Do we think that the transcendence of capitalism, by which I would mean the transformation of a system from one in which capitalism is dominant to one in which capitalism plays the role of a secondary set of institutions, do we imagine that transformation occurring in the conditions of the weakest forms of capitalism or in the conditions of the most vibrant forms of capitalism? Vibrant in the sense of smoothest, most stable, and so on. Now, the classic view of radicals has been the more crisis, the better, right? The more unstable and crisis-ridden is the system, the more likely we can transform it. That's true if you believe the only way of transformation is ruptural. It is certainly the case that a rupture in the system is more likely when it's weakest than when it's strongest. It's not so obvious that it's true if you think that the fundamental way you transform a society is by building the alternative inside of it. You build the alternative inside of it, you create an alternative ways of life, and then you worry about struggles of this symbiotic character to expand those spaces. Symbiotic and interstitial strategies, I think, are more likely to be successful in relatively robust economic systems within which capitalism continues to be viable, that is, it's not crisis-ridden, but in which the failures of capitalism can be remedied through interstitial alternatives. And then you have essentially a dual system, a hybrid system, in which you struggle in various ways to expand the space and vitality of the alternative. That may be an illusion on my part.
Well, I happen to agree with you, though, because I also think that the idea, the rupture idea, the idea that we'll have a socialist revolution here in the United States that'll be successful is pretty naive, given the obstacles. Unfortunately, we're out of time. I'd like to pursue that one a little further, but we can't. Eric Olenright, thanks so much for being my guest today.
My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.